You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. So we're joined today by Daniel Silva, who's the award-winning number one New York Times bestselling author of The Unlikely Spy, The Mark of the Assassin, The Marching Season, The Kill Artist, The English Assassin, The Confessor, A Death in Vienna, Prince of Fire, The Messenger, The Secret Servant, Moscow Rules, The Defector, The Rembrandt Affair, Portrait of Spy, The Fallen Angel, The English Girl, The Heist, The English Spy, The Black Widow, and House of Spies. His books are critically acclaimed bestsellers around the world and have been translated into more than 30 languages. His newest book is The Other Woman, which is out today, if you're listening to this podcast, the day we posted it. So welcome and thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
Thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be here.
So you've done this now for quite some time. You're an incredibly successful author, but this is our first crack at you. This is our first chance to talk to you here at Spycast. So I do want to ask you some questions about your early life, as we do have a lot of listeners who are trying to figure out what they want to be when they grow up. And you kind of took an interesting, I don't know, interesting is the wrong word. You took a kind of a roundabout route to get to being a spy novelist. Because you started off as a journalist, both in print and TV. But what made you want to kind of drop everything and start writing spy novels?
I would take a slight issue with the characterization of roundabout. I think that journalism has been a path for many novelists. You could go to Hemingway and Graham Greene, a couple of my literary heroes. And I became a journalist because I wanted to be a novelist. It was my goal pretty early in life. It was definitely something that was on my radar during my college years. And I literally chose journalism because I thought it would be the best path for me to achieve my goal, which was becoming a novelist. I thought it would be good training in the art of storytelling, that it would provide me with good experiences that I could draw upon later. And that turned out to be the case. I was able to serve in the Middle East as a journalist. So I had a brief but very successful journalism career. But it was in service of a larger goal, and that was to one day become a novelist.
What made you decide that now was the time? Like, was there a moment where you said, you know what, I think I've done what I needed to do in journalism, and now I can move on to writing that spy novel?
Yeah, I think that I felt that I had reached an age that was appropriate. I was in my early 30s when I started work on my first manuscript. I had reached a point in my career where I was something of a television news executive, where I wasn't really writing on a daily basis, and I really felt the need to apply fingers to keyboard and compose. So I had a spiritual need to write. I felt I was ready to write. And it was at that point, when I was about 33, I guess, that I began work on my first manuscript. And that manuscript would eventually become known as The Unlikely Spy, and that would become my first novel.
And this first novel was more historically based versus contemporary. Is that?
It was a total historical novel. It was a World War II thriller.
Is that easier to write when you're not trying to capture the kind of cultural, you know, feelings of the day when you're looking at things historically?
I don't know about easier. It was certainly fun. It was wonderful to go to a completely different place in my writing rather than the world in which I was living in. That was, you know, Washington politics and policy 24/7. And so every morning from about, you know, 4:30 or 5 until 9 o'clock, I was in a completely different place. I was in wartime London and Berlin. And it was a lot of fun. When people ask me for advice about writing their first book, I always tell them to try to enjoy it. Because once you sign a contract and it becomes work, it changes.
Right. Look,
I have most days I have a lot of fun doing what I do. But it's also true that there are deadline pressures, and publication pressures, and pressures from publishers and readers, and it does change once you become a professional.
Yeah, I mean, it's your job. I mean, it's you know, I spend the day when everyone's like, oh, you're the historian at the Spy Museum. How much fun? I'm like, it's my job, right?
It is a job, right? So that is my advice to the aspiring author novelist, is to please enjoy the actual writing of that first book, because it will never be the same again if you're fortunate enough to have that book published, or even more fortunate to actually make a career in this business, which is tough.
So who were, or even are, your go-to authors for the spy genre? I assume it's going to be some of the usual suspects from the kind of historical writing, but who are the modern day ones that you look at as well?
You know, I have to say that my inspiration comes from the older grandmasters, mm-hmm. And that there are a number of people working in the field whom I admire. I have to say from the outset that Vince Flynn was a personal friend. Our families were close. So I would count, obviously, put Vince as someone that I admired a great deal. But I think it's pretty clear from my writing style that my influences go back a ways. I'm very influenced by, John Le Carré and Len Dayton and those types of writers. But Graham Greene is a tremendous influence. Eric Ambler, who I think kind of invented the modern spy novel, is a tremendous influence on me. And that said, most of my reading, when I read fiction, I am not a, and I think a lot of people are surprised to see this. You know, a few years ago, I was asked to list my top five for the iBooks page. You know, what are your top five favorite novels? And only two of the five had anything to do with espionage and intrigue. My real When I read, I really read literary fiction.
Well, so does fiction or nonfiction help you the most? And maybe there's no yes or no answer to that, or maybe it's everything.
Oh, gosh. I mean, because of the kind of work I do and trying to stay contemporary and up to date on everything that's going on, I read a tremendous amount of nonfiction, obviously. Because I'm not a real ebook reader at all. In fact, I rarely buy a book, an ebook. I am buried in books at home. I am running out of space. I have a library with several thousand volumes in it. As I like to say to people, I'm either writing a book or I've got a book in my hand. I am fortunate enough to live a very literary a reading life. It's just part of my life.
Writing about intelligence can be tricky. I think we're a bit of a persnickety group, like, I guess, doctors and lawyers when they read books about that. We like the nitpick. So what kind of prep work do you find you have to do to make sure you try to get this right?
You know what? I do as much as I can. I talk to as many people as I can, and then I promptly don't worry about it.
That's a great philosophy.
And so, I am not writing for a handful of professional intelligence officers. I mean, I have a large readership out there. And so I try to get the culture right. I try to get the basics of tradecraft and technology right. But my first and foremost responsibility is to tell a compelling story. My character, Gabriel Lahn, has two very distinct sides to his makeup. He is a Israeli intelligence officer, assassin, spy, who worked as an art restorer as his cover job. And so the books have had a very strong art component to them, which have given them a very unique cast. And I think that has made the books appeal to a reader who might not necessarily pick up a spy novel.
Right.
In fact, I know that for a fact, that I have many, many readers who I'm the only quote unquote spy novel or novel of international intrigue. I'm the only person that they read in that genre, but they don't read other writers. And so I have always sort of felt that my books appeal to two types of reader. One is the dedicated reader of espionage novels, and then I have a whole other group of readers who came to the series for different reasons.
I want to ask you about your protagonist in a second. Let me ask you one last process question, because your books are full of twists and turns. That's what makes them compelling spy thrillers. And me, as someone who will almost certainly never write one, I just don't have it in me, I don't think. I wonder, are these planned out, or do you sometimes surprise yourself as you're going along, like, oh, crap, that would be a cool way to go, you know, without thinking about it beforehand?
Right. I rarely have all of the twists and turns mapped out when I start writing. In fact, I oftentimes have none at all. I like to see about 8 to 10 chapters of a book that I can, you know, write out in shorthand, and then I get to work. But I do not outline my books. I have found it. I've tried it a couple of times, and it's really just a complete waste of time for me. And I think that's true of a lot of sort of top tier thriller writers. I know that Michael Connelly doesn't bother with an outline. I know that Lee Child doesn't bother with an outline. It's never been a valuable tool to me. So that's a long way of saying, no, I don't know all the twists and turns. Now, you know, a couple of years ago, I wrote a book called The English Girl that had a very prominent twist in the novel. And without giving it away to our listeners, the English girl was not so English. I obviously knew what that twist was early. But really, I like to be a little bit surprised, or I like to take what I've written and then sort of hold it up to a mirror and turn it inside out, and build the twist that way.
Let me move on to talk about your protagonist, because I think this really, you know, you're an American writer and your protagonist is Israeli, and this really goes against that trite idea of write what you know. I mean, I'm thinking of the Tom Clancy or Jack Ryan was basically...
No, I'm going to interrupt. Very trite
idea.
Very, very trite idea. You know, did Thomas Harris know what it was like to be a psychopathic serial killer?
We hope not.
Let us hope not. But he wrote a darn good one. And so I've always found that to be really bad advice. Game of Thrones, I mean, goodness gracious. Write what inspires you, write what excites you, write about a world that you want to inhabit for a while, but for goodness sakes, don't limit yourself to writing only about what you know about intimately. Anyway, I digress and I interrupt.
No, you basically answered the question. I want to, how much of you do you interject into Gabriel? Or is it a chance to play with a complete alter ego?
No, I think that a writer, look, I've always found that subtext enters novels without the author's full participation, that it's sort of an unconscious process, that you unconsciously leave bits and pieces of yourself, not only in your main protagonist, but in other characters as well. And I think there's probably more to Gabriel. There's more of me in Gabriel than even I realize. There are certainly very obvious things about Gabriel and I, but there are some that are not so obvious about Gabriel and I. And I think the most important thing to remember about Gabriel Long is that he was never intended to be a continuing character. And, you know, it must sound crazy, but when I first created him, he was supposed to appear in one book and one book only. And I actually had to be talked into writing the second Gabriel Long. And I even had to be, when I submitted my proposal for what was the third Gabriel Long book, which is a little bit of a minor classic called The Confessor. When I first conceived that novel, it was not a Gabriel Long novel. And so here we are, my gosh, 18 years later, 9 New York Times number one bestsellers, and he was never intended to be a continuing character.
Well, I think I grew up reading Jack Ryan novels, Tom Clancy, and he's interesting because his longevity allows Tom Clancy to make him evolve. Do you find that same luxury with Gabriel, or is it?
Well, he has obviously evolved. When I first created Gabriel Long, he was sort of a figure out of Greek mythology. He was living outside Israel at the end of the earth in Cornwall, England. His family had been destroyed. He wanted nothing to do with his country and his service. And he had to be talked into accepting an assignment for Israeli intelligence. I never used the word Mossad in the series. I refer to them as the office, which is how they refer to themselves and conversationally. And so over that, I have written the books chronologically. They've gone in a straight line. They've been roughly in sync with the world as it is. And so Gabriel Long has gone from that man who was, you know, roughly in his mid to late 40s at that point. He's now the chief of Israeli intelligence. So he's on a Ryan-like trajectory. I'm not sure he'll ever be the prime minister or president of Israel, but I wouldn't rule it out.
I think the juxtaposition of Gabriel with Uzi is interesting. The action
Uzi
figure
has been there from the beginning.
And it's really this action figure. Sorry.
Sorry.
He's been in the first novel. Uzi Nabot was in the first novel. He and Gabriel were, he was very jealous and competitive of Gabriel, and that dynamic has been there from the very beginning. Uzi Nabot is one of my absolute favorite characters in the series. He's based loosely on someone I know, so I have a very clear vision of him when I write him. And I'm glad that you picked up on that. But anyway, I interrupted you. Please give me.
No, no. I mean, you're saying exactly what I was getting at. I mean, the action figure versus the quote unquote true spy. I mean, this has to be something that you're contemplating when thinking about your book plots, right? Counterterrorism or traditional espionage. That juxtaposition and that battle contemporarily is really the question that I think all novelists dealing in this genre have to think about. Like, is it a book about ISIS, like some of your previous ones, or do you go back to the traditional espionage? That to me is kind of personified in the tension between these two characters.
Well, I have, as I said, the Gabriel Lahn's character has allowed me to tackle all sorts of different subject matter. For two or three novels, his first novel was a straight counterterrorism novel set against the backdrop of Camp David in Oslo. He then did a three stories where he sort of served as an investigator of crimes of the Holocaust. And was wading through the unfinished business of the Holocaust, whether it was war criminals and money and art. He has battled the Russians on numerous occasions. He has battled the Iranians. He has searched for lost paintings. And so he has been able to, you know, I have a broad canvas and a varied palette when I write about Gabriel Lahn, and that's the true gift of the character. That's what he gives me as the novelist. I guess that whether it is a novel where he is trying to find a terrorist or prevent an attack or solve a mystery, all of the books have to have a certain amount of violence and suspense and intrigue. So, I mean, The Other Woman is a very traditional and very purposely so, sort of a traditional mole hunt,
yeah.
A little bit more of an espionage story. But I say that, and then it has complete, very commercial elements to it to make sure that it appeals to a mass audience. And so I guess that is a roundabout way of saying that all the books, whether they are deal with counterterrorism or something, you know, trying to steal a secret or something that's more traditional espionage, do have the requisite amount of action and intrigue. They are definitely hybrids when they're finished.
I was going to say The Other Woman is a wonderfully old-fashioned spy thriller, and I say that is one of the biggest compliments you'll get from me, kind of thinking back to the way they used to be written. And, you know, bringing back the Russians as a bad guy, they're such wonderful villains. Like, it's got to be so easy because they just provide so much information and so much material because they're just villains themselves.
This is the fifth novel in which Gabriel has tangled with the Russians. I wrote my first Gabriel Lahn / Russia novel was called Moscow Rules. I don't have to explain the Moscow Rules to you, but I wrote that book. I guess it was, I went to Russia to research it in the summer of 2006. It was published in 2007. And when I wrote that book, in Russia, we were on fairly friendly terms still with the Russians. And there was a lot of hope in the West that you know, Russia was going to go in a different path. And the time that I spent in Russia talking to journalists and dissidents and getting a sense of the place under Putin left me with a very just different impression of what our future was going to be with Russia. And I wrote a a very negative portrait of Russia in that novel. A lot of people sort of disagreed with it, and it turns out that I was correct. And so this is actually my fifth bite of the apple, at least Gabriel's. So he has a long history with the Russians, very long, violent history with the Russians. But the other woman is, at its core, a good old-fashioned mole hunt. And I can say it in this podcast without giving away too much. It does, the mole hunt stretches back into history to perhaps, you know, the greatest act of treason and treachery ever, and that's the case of Kim Philby. And so I very purposefully gave the novel a Cold War atmospheric and sensibility. And it's set in very Cold War settings.
Right.
Vienna, Bern. I borrowed incidents from the Philby case and applied them to my story. And just really set out to make the novel look, feel, taste, and read like an old-fashioned spy novel.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. Visit sixthsense.com to learn why enterprises choose them.
Let me ask you before, I want to talk about this mole hunt concept, but is it easier or harder to write about Russia now? Because they've really gone into the realm of Bond villain territory in real life. So how hard is it to kind of make it go beyond that for a novel? I mean, they're really, at this point, if you had written stuff about them using weapons grade chemical and biological weapons on the streets of London 10 years ago, people would be kind of, okay, sure. But they've now done it in real life. I mean, does it make it easier or harder for you?
I had no, you know what, I'm getting a little bit of feedback from the feed there. Look, I had no illusions about Russia. I knew that they were capable of this. If you go back to Litvinenko, they used polonium. Mm-hmm. They left a trail of radioactive material from Russia to the United Kingdom. They scattered it all over London. There was an indication right then and there that they were willing to do really reckless things.
Right.
But I must say that even I would not have written, I would not have been comfortable writing about the use of an ineffective weapon of mass destruction on the soil of the United Kingdom. And I still don't think we've really wrapped our head around that. And I don't even think the British government, at least not publicly, yes, they took pretty stern steps, expelled a few people, but even I'm still mystified that there's not more public outrage over this. And now we've had actually an innocent British subject die in this attack, having been exposed to sort of secondary Novichok that was some sort of level of contamination that sickened this poor woman. It is unbelievable to see the lengths to which these guys will go. But I've had a great deal of fun using the Russians as villains in the Elan series, because they are willing to do things that are on their face unbelievable. And they are good villains. And this novel sort of speaks to that. They are both have shown a propensity to be rather reckless in what they do, but they're also, and I wonder if your friends in the business would agree to this, we underestimate the SVR at our peril. This is a very old, accomplished, determined intelligence service. Vladimir Putin uses his intelligence service as a force multiplier, not only to gather information and collect intelligence on Russia's adversaries, but to affect policy and as sort of a weapon of hybrid warfare that the Kremlin has developed. And so it is fun to write about Russians as villains, but it's also deadly serious business because they are quite simply villainous.
You refer in the book to some of the historical revisionism happening today in Russia, the revitalization of the Stalin cult of personality. And I spent time in Russia back in 2005, just before you were there. Is this something that you noticed when you visited? I mean, this seems to be something that people aren't realizing, that the kind of the Stalin period, which we historically look at as being horrendous, is now being seen with nostalgia by a lot of Russians.
Absolutely. I mean, just a very basic little thing about that you could go into a Russian market or a Russian knickknack stand and buy nesting dolls with Stalin's image on it, or T-shirts with Stalin's face on it. I mean, can you imagine if you went to Berlin and you could buy an Adolf Hitler T-shirt?
Right.
Stalin has had a resurgence under Putin. Putin has definitely sort of used Stalin nostalgia to enhance his own appeal. This is something I wrote about at length, actually, in a book called The Defector. And it was actually sort of the spine of that novel, this bizarre rehabilitation of Stalin and Putin sort of borrowing from Stalin to enhance his own power. And unfortunately, it's part of a global trend right now. I mean, the strongman is on the rise. And if we sort of look across the globe right now and look at some of the basic indicators, democracy is in retreat. We have a neo-czar in Putin. We have a neo-emperor in Xi in China. We have a neo-sultan in Turkey. And so I think that I had occasion to reread the George Kennan's long telegram and his Article X, which is the sort of the basis of the policy of containment. And I think we really need to look at a new policy of containment when it comes to Putin. Donald Trump will have met with Vladimir Putin on the day before this interview is broadcast. We don't know the outcome of that meeting yet, but I think that we can expect that they will have a cordial meeting and that there will be pledges of cooperation. And you know, I'm just not sure we should be looking to cooperate with Vladimir Putin.
Right.
Two previous presidents have tried, and they have been paid the price for that. Donald Trump is not the first American president who has tried for better relations with Vladimir Putin. George Bush looked into his eyes, got a sense of his soul, as he famously said. Hillary Clinton famously pushed that silly reset button. And those attempts to make nice to Vladimir Putin failed, and they failed for a very specific reason, and that is Vladimir Putin does not want to be a friend of the West. Vladimir Putin wants to confront the West. Vladimir Putin wants his old empire back. He wants to weaken NATO, destroy NATO, weaken the special relationship between the United States and Great Britain, and those are all the themes that I deal with in the other world.
Yeah, and you had mentioned the idea of a mole hunt in Philby. I think Philby is really an interesting, particularly juicy historical figure, not like a Alder Ames or a Bob Hansen or John Walker, because his motivation is ideological, which is so anachronistic today. You just don't see that very much, unless it's someone running off to join ISIS. But very few people are spying because of true belief anymore. Was Philby just a wonderful historical figure to dive into?
I've been obsessed with Kim Philby since I was 22 years old and read My Silent War for the first time. I was horrified by Philby's actions. This man literally, he probably has the blood of several hundred people, if not more, on his hands, the people that he betrayed. Agents, freedom fighters, emigre people that we were trying to insert into the Soviet Union at that time. He got a lot of people killed. Did terrible damage to Western security. But he also led this incredible life. And so it was fun to play fictitiously with that life. Spin a story from some sort of gaps in that life, and that's what I did with The Other Woman. I've been intrigued with Kim Philby for a very long time, and this is a book that I wanted to write for a very long time, and I finally got around to it.
You do a great job kind of giving the ins and outs of a mole hunt. How much did you look at kind of the famous mole hunts from history to do research on how this would actually happen in real life?
You know what? I really focused like a laser beam on Philby himself. And I had read about the Aldrich Ames case, obviously. I mean, another great mole hunt. So the basic mole hunt at its core starts with the premise that, you know, We are losing assets, or things are going wrong. Why are they going wrong? And you start looking at who had access to what information and when. It's a very complicated process. And so I borrowed the basics of the classic mole hunt. But where I really found my inspiration for this story is taking the Philby case itself and overlaying it on top of my story and pillaging it at from beginning to end. And the inspiration for the beginning of the novel comes from the Philby case. In fact, there's a little tiny reference. You will see the name Volkov in the first chapter of the novel. Volkov was a KGB officer who was trying to defect to the West in the 1940s, And he was going to come out and tell MI6 that there was a mole within the service, that the KGB had planted a mole inside MI6, and Philby managed to get that man killed and thus protect himself. And he did it a couple of times, actually. He managed to head off defectors who could betray him. And that's sort of the inspiration for the story, drawing from Philby's life, applying it to my story, and thus giving the novel a very Cold War feel.
When you're weaving fictional characters in the narrative of real-life historical figures, how much of a dance is that? How much historical license do you allow yourself?
I am very careful with the historical license that I allow myself. And if you look at the author's note, I told the reader precisely where I broke what was history and what was fiction. And I don't want there to be any confusion at the end of it. Some writers prefer to just sort of, you know, leave the reader at sea, if you will, and let him figure out where truth ends and fiction begins. But I feel an obligation to tell the reader what is absolute truth or you know, accepted as truth, and where the fiction begins.
So let me wrap this up by asking you this question. Because you delve into the not all that new attempts by the Russians and others to use the media to control the narrative. And so as a former journalist, is this one of the most interesting aspects of the rejuvenation of the Russians as kind of the big baddie today, is their use of media and social media and disinformation?
Well, let's keep in mind look, the KGB perfected this technique going all the way back to the 1920s and 30s, and the period of active measures, where they were reaching out and trying to destabilize and affect events beyond the borders of the Soviet Union. And disinformation campaigns were part of that playbook. And you know, people always ask, are we in a new Cold War? Not yet, but I think we are the more analogous period is that period of the 1920s and 30s, where the Soviet Union was very young, and it was very aggressive in trying to affect events outside its borders, and trying to weaken its adversaries. And black propaganda and disinformation campaigns were part of that. The KGB has a long memory. It has been around longer than the CIA. They have a toolbox that they have in place. They've updated it, obviously, to account for new technology. But this is very old stuff, and they have shown, you know, quite obviously that they're very good at it.
Well, the book is The Other Woman. I can honestly say that it was refreshing to kind of reread a book that could have been written, if it wasn't for the modern day setting, could have been written, you know, during the height of the Cold War, because it really is an old fashioned spy thriller. And again, people know that that is a huge compliment coming from me. I really appreciated the time that you took today. All right. So Inside Baseball, I'll let you know, I'm not a big spy novel fan. I read them because I have to. I figured I would read this out of obligation to the job and not enjoy it, but I can honestly say I put it down and I said, damn, That was a damn good book. And I even told people, I'm like, you know, they're like, how was the Silva book? I'm like, you know what? I might have to go. Well, I have no time to do this, but I might have to go back and read the other ones at some point because I really enjoy this. I thought it was done in such a wonderful, old-fashioned way that really, really spoke to me. So I appreciate you writing this, and I congratulate you for putting this book together because it's really worth reading.
I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and have a great day.
Okay, take care.